Second case today is United States v. Henry. This is a certified case, so the government will go first. Government ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Jonathan Reiner, and together with Captain Allison Rowley, I represent the United States. Chief Judge, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The military judge abused his discretion in every way possible. He applied the incorrect law by functionally requiring the government to prove the charged crime before offering proof of that crime. In essence, he demanded that the entire house be built before admitting that there was a foundation for that house. His clearly erroneous findings of fact discounted all evidence inconsistent with his assumption of what occurred that morning. Most notably, the military judge found that the government failed to present evidence that 10-year-old J.H. was excited when he ran out into the below-freezing weather at 2 in the morning, wearing only pajamas and using the precise words of the Foundation witness, Staff Sergeant Carson. While J.H. was frightened, scared, afraid, and startled, screamed, "He's beating my mom, he's beating my mom." And the military judge incorrectly applied the law to the facts by focusing on when the assault occurred to the exclusion of applying the three-pronged Arnold test, looking to spontaneity, whether the statement was prompted by a startling event, and whether it was made while still under the stress of that startling event. This case is the dead fish that's been festering for 5 weeks, and this court should reverse. The military judge was influenced by an incorrect view of the law. He committed Borgerli error by basing his ruling on his belief that the ultimate crime didn't occur, rather than whether or not the foundation was met. His findings on the third Arnold prong, whether the statement was made under the stress of excitement, was based on his belief that the injuries did not match, the physical manifestation of the injuries did not match what was said in the statement. The underlying logic of this belief, embraced at pages 18 and 19 of Appelli's brief, is that KH wasn't beaten enough for this to have been an excited utterance. This is not and cannot be what the law requires. To the extent that there's any discrepancy between what was in the content of the utterance and the physical manifestation of the injuries, such a discrepancy might be relevant to the issue of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But as the analysis to Rule 8032 says, there is no requirement at all of corroboration or of independent evidence to corroborate the startling event. Indeed, the Supreme Court of Washington in Young said that an evaluation of the victim's credibility has no place in the excited utterance rule. The military judge also erred by focusing on when the startling event occurred to the exclusion of the remainder of the Arnold test. He asked at page 137 to 138 of the joint appendix, "Which witness told me during the course of their testimony, we believe the assault occurred at this specific time?" He was not looking for a point of reference to anchor the statements to. He was looking for this specific time. Only the Army Court's Henley opinion requires there to be a specific time. And that requirement, it's not rooted in any precedential case law, and is contrary to this Court's cases, such as Felton, that indicate that time by itself is not dispositive. The military judge ignored other Donaldson factors, including the characteristics of the event, the subject matter of the statement, and whether it was made in response to a question, all of which cut in favor of finding that this was made in under the stress of the startling event.
Major Reiner, may I ask a question?
Yes.
Did the military judge here make a credibility determination? Did he, after hearing the putative victim testify, conclude that her recantation was what should be believed by the court in terms of looking at supplemental JA page 44, where he says, "What evidence is in front of me that the statements of either the young boy or his mother were spontaneous, excited, or impulsive, rather than product of reflection and deliberation?" It seems there as if The military judge is saying, I've heard from the putative victim. I believe her recantation. And is the government therefore stuck with that determination, factual determination, by the military judge?
We are not, Your Honor, because to the extent that he heard from her, he heard from KH as a witness. Not KH the declarant, but KH the witness who testified in the pretrial Article 39A. At that point, when someone is actually a witness testifying, then their credibility is in play. But for the purposes of whether or not there is an excited utterance, credibility doesn't come into effect. Now, certainly when determining whether what weight to assign to that excited utterance, absolutely, credibility should come in there. But in terms of whether or not this excited utterance is admissible, credibility is not relevant, Your Honor. To the extent that he did make that determination, and this is, although it's 44 of the supplemental joint appendix, this is 245 of the record. So this is well into the Article 39A in the middle of the trial. To the extent that he was making that judgment then, that was inappropriate. Certainly at in the 50s and 60s of the record when she was testifying, her credibility should have been considered, but not in the 240s and 250s of the record when he's determining whether or not to admit the excited utterance. At that point, it is an inappropriate consideration. As this court noted in footnote 4 of Arnold, the stress of excitement can linger long after the startling event or after a traumatic episode. So even if there was a gap here, and there is no evidence to support that there was such a gap, but even if there was a gap in time, then it still would not be sufficient to preclude this statement from going into evidence. The military judge also erred by focusing exclusively on the fact that KH was crying while not considering that she was, that other words used to describe her were afraid, scared, frightened, and cowering. So he focused that on that she was crying to try to bind the facts of this case up with the Henley facts, where the Army Court found that crying by itself wasn't enough to show that the victim was still under the stress of excitement. Here, there is so much more than just crying that the military judge ignored. That was error.
Counsel, I asked a few questions. When we're determining whether a military judge abused his discretion in applying an evidentiary ruling, and the military judge has found facts relating to the foundation of whether the evidence is admissible or not admissible, do we review those facts under a clearly erroneous standard, or do we review them de novo based on, as you say in your brief, the preponderance of the evidence?
The findings of fact are reviewed to see whether they are clearly erroneous, and here there were clearly erroneous
findings. And can they be clearly erroneous on grounds that they're just not supported by the majority of the evidence?
It's clearly erroneous if this court has a definite and firm conviction that the record does not support them. And the court should have that.
Counsel, on a second point on that, part of your argument seems to be that the military judge did not give enough weight to the circumstantial evidence or did not draw sufficient inferences from the circumstantial evidence. Is that a basis for finding the finding of fact is clearly erroneous?
It's not just that he wasn't giving sufficient weight to it, Your Honor. He didn't even consider it. That is clearly erroneous. In fact, he said that, quote, there was insufficient evidence to support that J.H., the son, was excited, yet he didn't acknowledge, let alone explain why this wasn't sufficient, when the words used to describe J.H. were scared, frightened, afraid, startled, yelling, and screaming. So that all this has to satisfy the court by is that there was a preponderance of evidence, yet by any standard, when a child runs out at 2 in the morning across the street in below-freezing weather wearing inappropriate clothing and screams that one parent is beating the other, by any standard, when they're frightened, scared, afraid, and startled, that would show that the child is excited. The military judge said that there was insufficient evidence for that. He also erred in saying that there was no evidence that J.H. personally perceived a startling event. Perception will often be proved circumstantially, and in fact, the advisory committee note, Federal Rule 803, says that it can be inferable from the circumstances. Here, the circumstances which give that inference are that J.H. was petrified, that he ran out at 2 in the morning in pajamas, below freezing weather. There's also the force of the statement, the fact that everyone agrees that he was at a minimum in the vicinity of the assault.
Counsel, just on that specific point, it sort of relates to the one that I talked about before, that if the military judge had inferred from the circumstances that he had witnessed a startling event, we might not say it's clearly erroneous, but is it clearly erroneous not to infer it when there was no direct evidence? I mean, I think the real problem is the people who were there didn't testify.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it's contemplated that a declarant is not going to testify. Rule 803, the title of it expressly contemplates that the availability of the declarant is immaterial. Here, they didn't testify, and that there's no relevance on the admissibility of this as long as the foundation is met.
Well, I understand that. I understand that. And I understand also that if the military judge had inferred from the circumstantial evidence, there'd be nothing wrong with that. That would be entirely appropriate. But the question is, if the military judge does not make an inference from circumstantial evidence, when there's no other evidence, is that clearly erroneous?
It's clearly erroneous, Your Honor, in as much as even the military judge's alternative theory, which was based inappropriately on the Article 39A, rather than the pretrial 39A, as opposed to what was in front of him for the foundation. But his theory there was that the child was told by the mother that this happened, or heard his mother getting beaten. Under either of those two alternative theories, the child would still have experienced a startling event, and he still would have made the statement because of that startling event. When someone's mother, when a 10-year-old's mother wakes him up in the middle of the night and says, "Dad is beating me," that is going to be incredibly startling to the child. His subsequent statements still relate to that startling event. The military judge
also... Reiner, can I kind of follow up on Judge Maggs's question? I understood Judge Maggs to be asking on the very narrow question of when a military judge or trial judge abuses his or her discretion. And so maybe you answered to Judge Maggs' satisfaction, but I'm not sure I'm satisfied. The question I have, and it's in light of his, is are the findings that a judge makes just incomplete when he or she disregards evidence that is relevant material on the issue at hand? Or what are we to make of that? You know what I mean? In other words, your claim is that, hey, look, there's all this evidence on these circumstantial, on these circumstances here. The judge appears to have not regarded them at all, certainly not mentioned them. So is disregarding evidence that is clearly in the record an abuse of discretion?
If the military judge doesn't articulate a basis for disregarding evidence, particularly when we're talking about the great weight of the evidence, as in this case, that is an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Are the findings just incomplete, in your view, if he does that? In other words, if he makes findings, disregards some other stuff that's clearly in the record, are the findings just incomplete?
No, Your Honor, because he's basing his findings on selected evidence without putting any explanation for disregarding it. I believe it's more than being incomplete. Mm-hmm. It's that it is wrong. It is that it is clearly erroneous, and it is an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
But to clarify that point, the word that was just being used is disregard. How do we know that the military judge disregarded them as compared to, this was not a written ruling, and I recognize from the record that that was a point of contention between the military judge and the trial counsel here. But in terms of a military judge not citing to some evidence, isn't that potentially a distinction from him affirmatively deciding not to consider? So how do we know that the military judge disregarded it, meaning I am not going to consider this information as compared to failing to put it on the record?
His failure to put it on the record and selectively choosing other pieces to put on the record demonstrates that he abused his discretion by showing that he didn't consider all of the evidence that was in front of him. This has to be a determination made on the totality of the circumstances, and here he didn't consider the totality of those circumstances. That is error.
Counsel, are we now talking about factual findings that were incorrect or factual findings that were incomplete in terms of sustaining a particular viewpoint on the law, by ruling of law by the military judge?
I believe that they're both incomplete and incorrect, Your Honor.
Which ones are factually incorrect?
That J.H. was not excited, that K.H. was not excited, that there was no evidence at all about when the event occurred. In fact, both of the declarants had told Staff Sergeant Carson that, quote, something just happened, unquote. That's page 118 of the Joint Appendix for J.H. and 31 of the Supplemental Joint Appendix for K.H. J.H. said, beating my mom. Staff Sergeant Carson said that he's, quote, spoke in the present tense, unquote. So to say that there was no evidence of when the assault occurred, that was incorrect. That was clearly erroneous. With respect to the present sense impression, the military judge did not conduct a full separate analysis, but it was an abuse of discretion for all the same reasons that he abused his discretion on the excited utterance. Brown is the only military case that cites a specific amount of time, and there the Army Court found that up to 20 minutes could be sufficient. Federal circuit courts have found up to 23 minutes would be sufficient for present sense impressions. A statement including all the details that the military judge demanded would not be an exclamation, rather, it would be a narrative. The military judge lacked any appreciation that courts can consider circumstantial evidence. He ignored the weight of the foundational evidence, and he distorted the law such that nothing would qualify as an excited utterance unless it was cumulative to other evidence already in the record.
Major Reiner, I know you're getting ready to to conclude here and wrap up, and my question may go beyond his allotted time, but it's a very, very simple one. And it goes back to this issue about, I'm still not clear on this incomplete or disregarded question. And it's probably just me, but can you give me that one more time about why you think that, you know that you agree there's a distinction, as Judge Olson pointed out, right? And your claim is that these findings are inaccurate because they are based on the judge's conclusions, claiming that there is no evidence for this particular point or this issue.
Correct. His assertion, and I recognize I'm out of time.
Yeah, no, I understand.
His assertion that there was no evidence to support that shows that he is not considering the evidence in the record. So it's not just that he missed things. He's affirmatively saying this doesn't exist, when in fact it actually is in the record.
Okay.
And it's in the record in a rather overwhelming fashion.
Okay, I understand. Right.
This court should reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant.
Good morning. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Catherine Godfrey, and along with my co-counsel, Major Jody Grimm, we represent the appellee, Sergeant First Class Deshaun Henry. This court's job is not to relitigate the facts at trial. This court's responsibility is to determine whether the military judge abused his discretion, and here he did not. The military judge provided a detailed 10-page analysis and ruling in which he made sufficient findings of fact, amply supported by the record, and he correctly applied the law to those facts. Because he did not abuse his discretion, we ask this court to uphold his ruling. The government treats the admissibility of the proffered statements as a foregone conclusion, and argues the military judge had no discretion to exclude them. But the rule against hearsay is a rule of exclusion. Our system recognizes only limited exceptions when hearsay statements are admissible, and only when certain criteria under an exception are met may such statements be admitted. The military judge here provided the government with at least 14 opportunities to lay adequate foundations for the proffered statements. He allowed the government the opportunity to call Staff Sergeant Carson 3 times as a witness. He permitted the government to seek reconsideration of his rulings multiple times. It was the government's burden as the proponent of the evidence to establish adequate foundations, and they simply failed to do so. It is not the military judge's job to rescue them from their insufficient presentation of evidence. And because he did not abuse his discretion when he excluded the hearsay statements, we ask this court to uphold his ruling. Furthermore, the government spends time asking this court to go beyond the rules and impose a requirement on military judges to make value-based judgments on policy considerations rather than facts and evidence. A military judge's job is not to apply policy preferences. He's required to apply the law to the facts presented in evidence. Nor is this court's job to resolve policy disagreements. Such arguments should be made to Congress or the President.
Captain Godfrey, what about the government's point, the late point they were making with regard to whether or not the military judge made an express statement that there is no evidence to support admission of certain some of these statements, when in fact there is evidence on the record? At least in one instance, he pointed that out.
Your Honor, the military judge did not make any clearly erroneous findings of fact, and this court is limited to reviewing his findings of fact, his findings of law, and the application of law to those facts.
But what about that point where, let's assume for the moment, just hypothetically, that the military judge says, there's no evidence to support that, counsel, after he's heard oodles of evidence on it.
Your Honor.
What kind of finding is that?
One specific instance I believe Your Honor is referencing is the personal observation requirement. And the military judge must be satisfied that a declarant has, in fact, personally observed the startling event to admit the statement under the exception. Where courts have found, the Third Circuit, particularly in Miller versus Keating, that a declarant is merely repeating something someone else has said or is hypothesizing, or as in Bemis versus Edwards, the Ninth Circuit concluded, where there's an articulable suspicion that a declarant is repeating what somebody else has said and they have not personally observed the event, courts have properly excluded that statement. And here the military judge voiced an articulable suspicion that Master J.H. had not personally observed the startling event, the alleged assault.
Thank you.
Counsel, a related point. Do you agree with the government's position that the military judge refused to consider or did not consider circumstantial evidence?
I would disagree, Your Honor. The military judge, again, laid out in a very detailed analysis, while not a written ruling, this was not a cursory ruling from the bench. The military judge had recessed for the evening to consider all the facts presented to him up until that point and read through his ruling on the record.
What can you specifically point to with regard to that question about whether the military judge considered circumstantial evidence? Maybe he drew the conclusion that it didn't support admission of the evidence, but what is in the record that shows that he at least considered it?
Your Honor, for example, the military judge made a specific finding that he found Staff Sergeant Carson's testimony, or Staff Sergeant Carson to be unsure in his testimony, that he was considering weight there to the witness in court's testimony, where Staff Sergeant Carson had testified in court that Master J.H. had said that he's beating my mom, or excuse me, he had beaten my mom, whereas in his sworn statement, he had said that he's beaten my mom. He also specifically said that he was giving the sworn statement less weight because it was made 3 months following the alleged assault.
What are we going to make of the fact that the military judge seemed to focus on the fact that the term excited was not used by Sergeant Carson? Seems very odd. The military judge seems to be saying, well, this is the excited utterance exception. Sergeant Carson did not specifically use the word excited. What are we to make of a military judge saying that?
Your Honor, the military judge heard the testimony as the government submitted to this court that Staff Sergeant Carson had indicated that Master J.H. was frightened and appeared at his door at approximately 02 in the morning. The military judge...
Exactly. He said, startled, scared, afraid, frightened, and then the military judge saying, but he did not use the word excited. What are we to make of that?
Your Honor, the first Arnold prong under 8032, the statement needs to be spontaneous or excited and not the product of deliberation or reflection. And the military judge had previously had testimony from Mrs. KH indicating that that statement was not, in fact, spontaneous, that Mrs. KH had woken up her son for the express purpose of him going across the street to alert the neighbors to call 911 because she wanted to get her husband kicked out of his home.
Well, what about the government's position that, hey, this still should come in, let the panel members decide that at this stage, even if it had been the mother who was falsely telling the son this, it's still an excited utterance. What's your position?
Well, Your Honor, that was the first Arnold prong, that the statement be spontaneous. The government had still failed on the two remaining prongs, that Master J.H. had, in fact, observed a startling event and that he was under the stress and excitement of it. So the statement's
still not. Well, isn't it a startling event for the mother to go in and shake him awake at 2 o'clock in the morning and tell him to go in his pajamas running through the freezing cold weather to a neighbor he barely knows? Wouldn't that in itself be a startling event?
Yes, Your Honor, and theoretically that could be. That was not proffered to the military judge at trial. This was raised on appeal by the government.
Counsel, just trying to determine what points of agreement or disagreement we have between the parties as to what happened at trial. The government, in response to a question earlier, said there were three erroneous factual statements by the military judge. One, that J.H. was not excited. Two, that K.H. was not excited. And thirdly, that there was no evidence about when the event occurred. Now, does the defense in this case agree that those were factual findings by the judge?
Your Honor, we do not agree with the government's assessment as they being clearly erroneous findings.
I understand that, but do you agree that the judge made those three factual findings in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And why is the statement that J.H. was not excited a factual finding as opposed to a legal conclusion drawn from facts about whether something is excited within the meaning of the rule? In other words, was the judge making a legal determination then or a factual determination?
At that point, Your Honor, I believe he was making a legal conclusion as to the first prong in Arnold under 8032.
Okay, and what's our standard of review there?
It is for abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Pending any further questions, we ask this court to uphold the military judge's ruling.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a few points on rebuttal, Your Honor. First, I'd like to start off by reminding this court of what the Sixth Circuit, sitting en banc, said in Arnold. The excited utterance may be based solely on testimony that the declarant still appeared nervous and distraught, and there was a reasonable basis for continuing to be emotionally upset. By that standard, all four statements should be admitted overwhelmingly. Appellee indicated that the government is injecting into the appeal for the first time that the mother might have woken him up. Actually, that was the military judge who brought that in, and that was based on the Article 39A pretrial testimony. This is not a new argument on appeal. And finally, with respect to whether J.H. had personal observation, Appellee argued based on Miller and Bemis. Both of those cases were correctly decided, and those go to show why J.H. had personal perception here. With respect to Bemis, in that case, there was a 911 call, and in that 911 call, the declarant could be heard admitting that he could not see what he was describing. That is not present here. In that 911 call, he could be heard repeating the words of others. Neither of those factors are present with respect to J.H.'s outcry. And finally, with respect to Miller, there was no evidence in Miller about the unidentified declarant's tone, demeanor, or other circumstances that could give inference of perception. Here, there's ample evidence that J.H. was beside himself. He was completely distraught as he ran across the street at 2 in the morning wearing inappropriate clothing. So Miller,
Mr. Reiner, before we run out of time, can I ask you about the 911 call?
Yes.
Now, that seems to have taken place at a point much later in this timeline.
Right? Approximately an hour and a half later.
Yeah, isn't one of the purposes of the excited utterance exception is that we want to bring in statements that are truly the result of a fairly recent startling event? I mean, and the whole idea is that we don't want to have statements come in where people have had some time for reflection.
Yes, Your Honor. And, in fact, this Court has previously allowed cases where someone was calming down for a half hour and then they admit it. Whereas here, K.H., she was only, quote, a little bit calmer, unquote, than when she was cowering by the closet when she made that 911 call. Staff Sergeant Carson testified that she was visibly upset when she was making the 911 call. So she was still laboring under the stress of excitement.
But isn't that something that reasonable folk could disagree on? And if that's the case, that goes to the military judge's abuse of discretion on that particular statement, does it not?
I see that I'm out of time. May I answer and conclude?
You might disagree that reasonable folk can disagree.
Answer the question.
I do disagree, Your Honor. The reason that I disagree is because even though there is that space of an hour and a half,
mm-hmm.
there is still overwhelming evidence that KH is under the stress of excitement. She was cowering and now is only a little bit calmer. She is still upset. We're not asking this Court to lower the bar for domestic violence victims. We're just asking the Court to not allow a military judge to raise the bar, not making a policy argument. And for those reasons, we would ask this Court to reverse the judgment of the military judge.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Judge Everett.
One question here. Again, with respect in terms of the dialogue that we had and the dialogue with opposing counsel, is the determination by the military judge that J.H. was not excited and K.H. was not excited, are those strictly factual findings or are those legal conclusions? For purposes of our standard of review, that is, when the judge made that determination, was the judge determining that as a matter of law, these statements were not excited?
He said that there was insufficient evidence to support excitement. So in that respect, it is a factual finding, but then he made the legal conclusion that it did not, that because there was that factual absence, according to the military judge, that as a matter of law, they were not excited. So it's a little of column A, a little of column B.
Thank you.
Thank you for
counsel.
Your time and attention.
The Court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted, and the Court is in recess pending further order of the Court.